Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. This week, we've got a bunch of movies, and one of them is still sort of marginally a horror movie, so that's kind of appropriate. It's October, fully steeped in horror movie season. I'm about a third of the way through the Universal Classic Monsters. We'll talk about that another time, but today we're going to be talking about the update of the Universal Classic Dracula with Dracula Untold. We'll also be talking about The Judge, Kill the Messenger, Automata, and Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day. There will also be news in the trailer park and some box office predictions. And of course, the world famous DVD roundup. I have a bunch of stuff in that at the end of the show. So you want to listen to that before you start renting stuff this weekend so you can see what's probably the better choice either to rent or to buy for that matter. But before we get to all that, this is how you get a hold of me. You can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com and facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. If you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
That's right, Ron Burgundy. Rolling into the news, the first thing, and this kind of sort of dominated at least a lot of movie fans that I know and television fans, because it's really not a movie. This news story that Twin Peaks is getting a Showtime continuation series. Now, if you didn't watch Twin Peaks, that was in the early 90s. A groundbreaking show by David Lynch, very out there, very bizarre. Who Killed Laura Palmer? It was characterized as a soap opera. And I actually even remember my mom used to subscribe to Soap Opera Digest, and they actually covered Twin Peaks in that. But it's so much more than a soap opera because it has that bizarre David Lynch feel to it. Not as out there as something like Eraserhead, but it definitely embodied David Lynch films of the 90s. We'll see what happens. I mean, it's 25 years since this thing originally aired, and I know people are like, oh, the answers. Well, we all thought we were going to get answers from Fire Walk With Me, which was the movie that was produced. And yeah, he wanted to do more movies, but all Fire Walk With Me did was just open up more questions. I love Twin Peaks. I'm curious to see it. Hopefully it'll be good like Fargo was, but we'll see. But it's an interesting thing. I mean, this was a force of cinematic filmmaking before it really became a thing. And I'd like to see what they do with that. The next piece of news, and this was a quick piece of news that hit last week that I didn't cover yet. Focus Features and Leica are entering a new three-picture deal. Now, of course, they did Coraline, Paranorman, and The Box Trolls. They made enough money with that to continue. And that's great because, like I said, when I reviewed The Box Trolls, not everything has to be Pixar or DreamWorks. It's okay to have these smaller movies that don't do massive box offices, but are just beautifully crafted films. And I loved all three of the Leica movies. I'm looking forward to three more coming from Focus Features. Now, I could continue to talk about some of the news, like Terminator Genesis getting a PG-13 rating, or another writer unsurprisingly hired for the Ghostbusters reboot with the female cast. But let's kind of pull the veil back on movie news a bit and talk about a couple things that are swirling around the Marvel universe that's interesting. First piece of weird Marvel news is Robert Downey Jr. this week came out talking about saying, I'm going to do Iron Man 4, but only if Mel Gibson directs. Then later on Letterman, he's like, nah, I'm not going to do it. It's not in the works. It's not happening. The only one guy I really saw nail it, and it was Scott Mendelson on Forbes, who basically said, no, he's talking about Iron Man 4, so you'll write about it, so people will talk about Robert Downey Jr., because he's got a movie opening this week that nobody is connected to the Iron Man universe. It was a brilliant tactic by Robert Downey Jr., but that's all it was. It was just a bait and switch, talking about Iron Man 4 to get people to write about it so the judge is higher in their mind. Dovetailing into more sort of speculation in the Marvel Universe, Sony is now allegedly working with Marvel Studios, which is owned by Disney, to include Spider-Man into the Avengers somehow. Now, nobody knows how this is all going to shake out and how this is going to relate to the rebooted Spider-Man, but I think this does two things. First of all, it shows that everybody wants a piece of this pie. And second of all, it shows that Spider-Man reboot series, even though it did well globally, it's a disappointment to the studio. It's not the juggernaut that it was in the early 2000s when they first made Spider-Man movies. Similarly, Fox is trying to tie together the Fantastic Four and X-Men, and that's even more interesting because they've got two major properties from Marvel, and they want to tie these two together, and maybe they're trying to create their own thing so they don't have to partner with Marvel Studios. But what's also interesting about this is Marvel, which is actually owned by Disney, because Marvel Studios is owned by Disney, and Marvel, the comic and the licensing manufacturer owned by Disney, Marvel has killed the Fantastic Four comic series. They're stopping publication, and they're not allowing the merchandising of it. And that's interesting, because we've got the Fantastic Four reboot coming. Some people have speculated that it's Marvel and overseen by Disney, you know, sticking it to the Fantastic Four. But I think part of it might just be Marvel doesn't care about supporting somebody else's movie franchise, and because it's owned by a bigger company. And that's business. That's the way it works. This isn't a spat on the schoolyard. This is Marvel Studios, Marvel and Disney saying, why should we build all this merchandising to help fund 20th Century Fox's films? This is an interesting blowback that comes when you've had these properties spread all over the place. I mean, I'm sure they would have played hardball with the Hulk, too, if Universal hadn't have worked with them to get him in the Avengers. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out, because they were able to link the studios to do the Avengers. You had Paramount, you had Disney, you had Universal, all had a stake at some point in these characters, and it all worked out. But it's all going to end up under Disney. I mean, because Disney owns it. Disney's the one that's calling the shots on this one. That's business, man. You can't feel sorry for 20th Century Fox, because they're big business anyways. It's not like the big guy against the little guys. It's two big guys fighting in the playground. Somebody's going to win, and it's probably going to be Disney. With that sound, that means we're going to be rolling into the trailer park. There's two I really want to hit. Speaking of Disney, let's hit the first one. Big Hero 6, which looks absolutely freaking adorable, is the latest film from Disney's animation studio, not Pixar. It's interesting to note, because this studio did Wreck-It Ralph and Tangled and Frozen. It did not do Cars and Toy Story, even though they're both under the same umbrella, just like Marvel. So anyways, Big Hero 6.
I would like to help. Scan complete. You are experiencing mood swings. Diagnosis? Puberty.
Whoa, what?
Reports are flooding in about a major catastrophe.
We're under attack from a supervillain, people!
Come on, go, 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 go!
I am not fast.
Yeah, no kidding!
We gotta catch him.
We can't go against that guy. We're nerds!
Trust me, I know about robotics. We can be way more.
This movie looks cool. This movie looks very heartfelt and warm, and it really has starting to get that Pixar feel to it, that sweet, adorable, warm-hearted Pixar feel, but it's not quite Pixar, and that's okay. I think you can have competition within one studio itself. It's fine to have, like, Frozen going up against Monsters University last year. That's fine. That's how this thing works out. So I'm looking forward to Big Hero 6. It looks like it's going to be a fun, wholesome family movie. The next film I want to talk about in terms of the trailer is American Sniper. That opens on December 25th.
Hold on, I got a woman and a kid 200 yards out moving towards the convoy. Her arms aren't swinging. She's carrying something. Yeah, she's got a grenade. She's got an RKG, Russian grenade. She's saying to the kid.
You say a woman and a kid?
You got eyes on this? Can you confirm?
Negative. Your call.
They fry you if you're wrong.
Now, this is Clint Eastwood's new movie, and it's obviously about a sniper, true story, the most deadly sniper around. And nothing says Merry Christmas like a morally challenging movie about killing people. Now, what's interesting is this trailer's pretty intense, but it does hint at very typical Clint Eastwood filmmaking. He's very deliberate now. He's never been like a lickety-split action director anyways. But now that he's in his, you know what, like he's what, 112 years old or something like that, talking to chairs and going kind of crazy at times, he's very, very slow and deliberate in his movies. Stuff like J. Edgar dragged in a lot of ways, and a lot of his movies do. I'm sure this one will, but this one looks like it's at least subject appropriate, because that's what a sniper does. A sniper's life is not exciting. It is sitting around waiting for a target, and then like 30 seconds of excitement, and then being completely quiet and unseen. And maybe this movie will benefit from that. So it's a Christmas Day release, which it doesn't have anything to do with Christmas. It's the weirdest Christmas release schedule, because we've got this, we've got A Hot Tub Time Machine 2, and we've got The Interview. We don't have Christmas movies coming out on Christmas. It's bizarre. Anyways, I need to go to a break. When we come back, I'm going to be talking about Dracula Untold and The Judge. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys of the Movies coming back. We're going to be talking about our first movie, which is marginally a horror film. I mean, it's about Dracula. And here's the thing. Vampires have been pulled all over the genre map recently, especially with Twilight. Thank God that crap's over. I mean, it's going to be on Facebook, but I'm not watching it. But the biggest thing going for this in terms of vampire movies, the vampires don't sparkle in this, and that's good. We're getting back to good old-fashioned vampires that are vampires and not wispy-eyed, mopey, angsty lovers that we saw in the Twilight series. This movie is meant to be the beginning of a shared universe, Universal Monsters series, which, of course, they did way back in the day in the 30s. Well, 40s was when they started to link them all together. I think Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman was the first one that crossed the monsters over. And then, of course, you had House of Frankenstein, House of Dracula. And then, you know, you had the comedies like Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. And people responded to that like crazy. And they're trying to redo that, which what's funny is they could have. Back in the 90s, there was a series of remakes. You had Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula. You had Kenneth Branagh's version of Frankenstein. And then, well, you had Wolf. They didn't have the Wolfman remake until about, what, 4 years ago in 2010? Well, and those were all done by different studios. Universal had the Wolfman. So this is Dracula, and it's telling the story more historical. So the classic Universal vampire gets an origin story as Vlad Tepes tries to save his people from invading Turks.
The Sultan is preparing for battle and requires 1,000 boys for his army, including your son.
You can't protect us.
I'll find a way.
What is it you are seeking?
I want the power to destroy my enemies and save my family.
Drink, Dracula.
This is less of a horror movie and more of a historical action war film. It has horror elements. It has vampires and fangs and blood. But, you know, the blood's actually pretty minimal because it's going for a PG-13 rating. It's bizarre because you've got Dracula Untold, which a lot of people would say, well, it's a horror movie. It should be rated R. And you've got The Judge coming out, which we'll talk about in a couple minutes, which is, in this essence, a family drama that really doesn't need to be rated R. It's mainly just rated R for some language and minor context. But Dracula Untold is meant to be a movie that plays more as an action film. And it tells the story, the untold story of Vlad Tepes. I think it gives a more comprehensive approach than Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula did, which framed it much more in the horror movie gothic Victorian element. This film is meant to really just sort of plant the seed for later films, and they definitely leave it open for that at the end. So we'll see what ends up happening. If this one doesn't do well, I don't know what's going to happen to their series. It's fine. I mean, they make a hero out of Dracula, which is a little tough because Dracula is a villain. Dracula is a vampire. And Vlad Tepes was not a nice guy. And they have a point in there where they sort of gloss over, oh, yeah, that, you know, where I like impaled entire villages. Yeah, it was a good thing I did that. So there were just sacrifices, the innocent sacrifices to save thousands. They gloss over that really quick. And that's the reality is, Vlad the Impaler was a horrible person with bloodthirsty cruelty in his veins. Have nothing to do with being a vampire. And so they try and make him a little nicer. They romanticize him a bit. And it does have a bit of a love story there. So it's sort of this monster version of Braveheart. It was what it tries to be. Let's put it this way. It's way better than the I, Frankenstein nonsense that came out in January. I support in all aspects, the return of the classic monsters in crossovers, as long as they're done decently and nobody's sparkling. So overall, I'm going to say Dracula Untold kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I'm going to talk about is The Judge. As I grew up in Columbus, Ohio, and there was a TV show, and I think it was a local show called The Judge. And it was a dramatized version of what would have been the People's Court. And that's what I think of when I think of The Judge. That, I mean, like, oh, is it this really crappy homegrown production? No. It's a big budget movie. Directed by David Dobkin, who, that's the weirdest thing, is that this is the guy who did Wedding Crashers and I think Shanghai Nights. I mean, he's known for comedies. And while a lot of people are classifying this as a comedy, it's really more of a drama. So it's him stepping out of his wheelhouse and trying to take along some big names with it. Robert Downey Jr. plays a fast-talking Chicago lawyer who returns to a small hometown in Indiana for his mother's funeral, only to discover his father, a respected judge in the county, is arrested for murder.
Biggest mistake of your career and you just happen to run him over?
Forensics found traces of blood on your dad's car.
I sat on the bench in that courtroom for 42 years.
This was an accident, period.
We need to establish a firm defense.
There's no we here, Henry.
I can't stay.
You're a lawyer. He is your father. You leave now, you will regret it.
You're a shined-up wooden nickel, Mr. Palmer. I'm going to impale your client on a first-degree murder charge.
My father's a lot of unpleasant things, and murder is not one of them.
This is one of the most obvious award bait movies I've seen in a long time. It's clearly Robert Downey Jr. saying, you know, Iron Man's good and all, but let me get some success outside of that. And it's him trying to do drama again. And that's fine. I'm not making fun of Robert Downey Jr. for doing that, but it's very obvious that's what he's doing. It sort of reminds me of when they did Due Date. He did Due Date, I think, between Iron Man 2 and Avengers. And that was a straight up comedy. Dark comedy, but it was a straight-up comedy, and it was Robert Downey Jr. trying to stretch outside of Iron Man, because Iron Man has been great for him in his career, and he's a billionaire because of it, practically. But actors never want to be known for just one thing, and they never want to be pigeonholed, even if it's the most profitable pigeonholing you can do. Ooh, that sounds dirty. Let's move on. It runs too long. It's about 2 hours and 20 minutes, and it runs too long because it tries to do too many different things. On one hand, it's trying to be this high-priced yuppie from the big city coming back and reconnecting with his hometown. And he's got to reconcile with his dad and his brothers and his old girlfriend. At the same time, it's also trying to be this tense courtroom drama, because you got Billy Bob Thornton as the opposing counsel. This is like the fastest murder trial you'll ever see in the history of the universe. I don't know how quickly they go through this, but it gives the appearance that it's like done and done in like a month, if that, because he's in the middle of another trial up in Chicago, and he's just postponing that. And now he's working on this trial. It's just, from any sort of realism standpoint, it doesn't fit. It doesn't work. And the problem is it tries to be the courtroom drama, and it tries to be the family drama. And those are two big things to chew at once, and it's trying to do them both at the same time. I'm not saying you can't have both, but they're trying to make both the focus of the movie, and they get in the way of each other. It's also incredibly cliche. We've seen all this stuff before. We've seen all the twists and all the turns and all the one beats and the shockers and the surprises and the relationships. It's been over and over and over and over and overdone. And not in a mildly entertaining way, the way This Is Where I Leave You hit a lot of the same points, but still had an entertaining edge to it. The only reason that this movie works is because the actors are very good. I mean, you've got Robert Downey Jr., you've got Robert Duvall, you've got Vera Farmiga, you've got Billy Bob Thornton. You got a lot of good people working in this movie. That's why it works. But it still doesn't rise above just your standard made-for-TV Perry Mason goes home and tries to reconcile with his dad kind of movie. And if you're a huge fan of these people, you might enjoy it. But overall, I'm going to have to say it kind of sucks just because it just really didn't do it for me. I didn't hate it. Some people are hating this movie, but I didn't hate it. It was just there. It existed. So, yeah, they're going to put that on the Blu-ray cover box. It existed. Kevin Carr, Fat Guys at the Movies. Kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. I need to go to a break. When I come back, we're going to be talking about Kill the Messenger and Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day. Welcome back to Fat Guys in the Movies. Kevin Carr here, rolling into the next movie review segment. The next one I want to talk about is the other wide release we have. There are a couple limited releases we're going to be talking about later on. One of them is rolling out, which is Kill the Messenger, which is in the middle of a rollout for award season, getting a jump on that. And the other one is Automata, which is mostly on demand, and you can find it in some limited theaters. But right now, I want to talk about the family film, the Disney movie, Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day. Steve Carell and Jennifer Garner play parents of four children who all have a terrible day, and they must band together as a family to get through it.
day is so cursed.
You are not passing the blame on this one.
It was her fault.
I don't feel bad. I won't hurt anyone. Stop!
I think that you just gotta have the bad days so you can love the good days even more.
Trust me, I would know.
We are not going to let this day get the better of us. Are we ready, Coopers?
Yes!
Let's go, Wreck-It Ralph.
You have no idea the kind of day we are having.
This is one of those movies where it's based on a picture book. And when I say picture, it's like 200 words. It's not a very long book. I mean, it's 200 words. Most of those words are repeating the title. And that's fine, because that's what picture books do. And those are always a challenge to do, because you have to add so much. Because if you filmed it as a picture book, it would take 4 minutes. You know? The greatest example of misfiring on that is The Polar Express. If you read The Polar Express, it's a brilliant book, beautiful book. But they add so much crap into The Polar Express. Aside from all the Uncanny Valley nonsense with the kids and the creepy eyes, The Polar Express spends so much time diverting itself and then getting back on track. Literally. While it works as sort of like that traditional Christmas movie, The Polar Express still is kind of a failure in adapting the book, because the book is so simple and easy. Now, Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day is a great book, and I loved it as a kid. I use The Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad all the time. That's sort of part of my lexicon. I think it's a cool way of saying it. And this movie has to add a lot to the book, and to the point that there's Alexander, and bad things are happening to him during his day. But it's almost unrecognizable from the original picture book. But that's okay in this context, because Disney has crafted a really good, wholesome family movie out of it. You know, it pushes buttons. It does things that we've seen before. And that's fine, because it's a family movie. But the thing is, it runs like 80 minutes. It is a short, short movie. And if you're going to have any advantage in this marketplace for making a kid's movie that parents are going to enjoy, it's to make it short, because the last thing you want to see is a 2-hour and 15-minute version of a picture book. And they don't do that here. The other thing they do is Steve Carell and Jennifer Garner, who just are, the parents are just fleetingly mentioned in the book. They're sort of the anchors on it. Alexander's the title character, and he's sort of what it's all built around, but it's really Carell and Garner's movie. But you know, they do fine jobs. They actually work. They're realistic. It's nice to see a woman in her 40s actually playing a housewife instead of the grandmother, which is what Hollywood tends to do nowadays. So, and yeah, Steve Carell's 10 years older than her, but at least you can imagine them together. It's not like having, you know, when Magic in the Moonlight came out and you had Colin Firth macking on Emma Stone. That was almost creepy. But then again, that was Woody Allen. One of the things that I really like, it's a very pro-family movie, and this is why I think it's a strong film. In a movie like this, it's very tempting to have everybody dumping on the kid, dumping on Alexander. He's the butt of everybody's problem. And it's very easy to write the parents as scolding him and taking it out on him, but they don't do that. And I think that's rare to see in movies. And it's daring to do in movies, because that's an easy way out. And it's much easier to have the parents yelling and screaming and being mean to the kid and then coming back and being like, oh, I just had a bad day too. It's a lot more challenging from a writing and filmmaking standpoint to have the parents be supportive throughout and trying to be optimistic and trying not to make their kids feel like absolute garbage. And that's cool. They do band together as a family, and it shows the family working together. And I think that's a good thing. I think we need more of that from Hollywood, especially from kids' movies. And while everybody's frustrated, it's not like Alexander is the scapegoat. He's the conduit more than anything else. So I enjoyed it. I took my 11-year-old and he enjoyed it. It's a cute movie. I mean, if you're really prudish and you don't want, you know, bathroom humor, there's also a real interesting scene about male anatomy, which is pretty frank, but not unrealistic or inappropriate. And they handle that stuff really, really well. Again, this is what families deal with, and you're actually putting it on screen in a major motion picture from Disney aimed at the family market. I think that's a cool thing. So I'm going to say Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day is not terrible and horrible. It's good. And I say it rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys of the Movies with Kevin Carr. Next up is Kill the Messenger. Jeremy Renner plays journalist Gary Webb, who first uncovered the connection between the CIA and drug trafficking that led to the crack epidemic in the U.S.
One of the DEA's most wanted brought in thousands of kilos of cocaine to the U.S. every day. For them.
For who?
The U.S. government. Or with them. Or at least while they were looking the other way.
Jesus.
L.A., New York, Atlanta. I couldn't sell it fast enough to keep up with supply.
What you found here, Gary, is a monster.
You have no idea what you're getting into.
Are you really telling me that I should just walk away from this?
You'd be an idiot not to.
Similar to The Judge being a desperate attempt for Robert Downey Jr. to get an Oscar nomination, this is a bit of a desperate attempt for Jeremy Renner to get another Oscar nomination. These sort of one-person, non-ensemble pieces, Oscar bait movies, they're oftentimes good for the resume. The problem that you have with a movie like this is it becomes almost too much about the character. Everybody always talks about how we don't focus enough on the characters in movies in Hollywood anymore. Well, there are some movies where they focus too much on the character. And that's what you get with Kill the Messenger. You end up with a movie that the first act is awesome. The first act is All the President's Men times 10. It is a taut political thriller as he's uncovering this story. And of course, the real story behind it is Gary Webb just he wrote for the San Jose Mercury News, which is not an unknown paper, but it's not New York Times or anything, or the Washington Post. It's in essence, in terms of big newspapers of the 90s, it was one of the small town newspapers, even though it wasn't. It's still a major newspaper. But Webb uncovered this stuff and it was very titillating and dangerous information back then. I remember when the story was breaking. Like I said, the first act of him uncovering it and releasing it and the reaction is pretty amazing. The second act is sort of the blowback from it, and that's starts to deteriorate by the time they get to the third act. The movie just falls apart, and here's why. Because it goes from being this intense political movie to becoming the story of a guy whose life is crumbling around him and he's dealing with family and work and becoming homeless. And while this is all real and Gary Webb and has a tragic story. If you want to Google him, you can Google him. I'm not going to say anything because not really a spoiler to the movie, but the full end of this story is pretty tragic. And I'm not discounting any of the struggles that Gary Webb actually went through. It's just, it turns into a totally different movie in the last half. And part of it is because it is, again, one of the problems when you base something on a true story, you don't get the denouement that you expect from a big, contrived, written film of fiction. They're staying true to the story, but it's really just about this guy whose life just implodes. And when his life implodes, then it just turns into this Oscar bait movie. And he does a fine job. Jeremy Renner does a fine job in the role. And you've got some good performances by like Oliver Platt he's one of the editors and his direct editor is Mary Elizabeth Winstead. But ultimately, it doesn't pack the punch at the end that it does at the beginning, and it suffers because of that. So if you want to see Jeremy Renner really doing a good job, and I'm sure Jeremy Renner loved the script because it gave him a lot to work with. But in terms of story, the story just disintegrates in the last half. Ultimately, though, I'm going to say Kill the Messenger kind of rocks because it's worth checking out and it has some interesting insight, but that's about it. It just kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
All right, I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Automata, box office, and the world-famous DVD Roundup.
It was a one-eyed, one-horned, flying purple people eater.
One-eyed, one-horned, flying purple people eater.
A one-eyed, one-horned, flying purple people eater sure looks strange to me.
Kevin Carr wrapping you up for Fat Guys of the Movies. We've got a couple more things to talk about. Don't leave just yet. It is time to hit one more movie that's either it's in limited release. You're not going to be able to find it in too many theaters, but you can get it online in your on-demand outlets, iTunes, Amazon, various streaming capabilities, and that is Automata. A man is hired to track down evolving robots and discovers that the machines might be becoming more human than expected.
A machine altering itself is a very complex concept. Self-repairing implies some idea of a conscience.
It was staring at me.
I shot it because it looked
alive.
You know what happens once that is altered? Two of them try to alter a third one. Then the miracle dissipates. The epidemic begins.
This one stars Antonio Banderas. It also stars his wife, a smaller part, Melanie Griffith. You heard her in the trailer. And it's directed by, I think, Gabi Ibanez. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. Who's a Spanish director who's worked with him before. This is, it's an English production, so you don't have to worry. You know, for those of you out there who be like, I'm not going to watch something if it's in another language because I can't understand that nonsense. It's in English. You'll be fine. Ever since Isaac Asimov laid down his three laws of robotics in his robot novels back in the 50s, there have been a lot of movies that have tackled these concepts. I mean, obviously you had iRobot, the really hackneyed adaptation of his original books. You also have the three laws of robotics show up in Alien, or Aliens rather. Bishop quotes the first two laws of robotics. And you see the laws of robotics permeating through, because these would be things that you'd want to hardwire into their programming to keep the human race safe. Now, this one plays a bit with the laws of robotics, and it calls them protocols. And the first one is obviously, it's a very Asimovian law, and it says robots are not allowed to hurt other people or themselves. But the other parts of it is that the one of the protocols is robots are not allowed to alter themselves. And the reason for this being that they don't want them to improve themselves beyond that of the human race, and they don't want them to create their own robots that aren't following these protocols, which it's kind of astute science fiction filmmaking at that point, and they have it hardwired into the programming. And it's about a guy tracking these down. It sort of has a bit of a Blade Runner feel in the sort of that dystopian future of 2044 is when it takes place. So yeah, we're what, 30 years away from that? We're 5 years away from Blade Runner, by the way. For those of you who don't know, we're 5 years away from when Blade Runner took place, which that's enough to blow your mind. But Automata takes place in 2044. It's this Blade Runner mentality of him tracking down the robots, but it also has this iRobot feel to it where he's discovering the humanity in robots. And, you know, you see these issues have shown up in Star Trek with Data in particular, the character of Data. It tackles some interesting ideas and interesting concepts. And I think it's effective in that sense. It is a bit choppy in terms of pacing. And it maybe would have been a good hour-long TV show, but it does kind of try to stretch itself out and turn into an action movie at the end. But still, ultimately, it's a decent film. It's worth seeing if you like sort of alternative sci-fi and you don't want to see the big blockbuster. If you don't want to see something other than the Avengers or Star Wars, this is an interesting take. So I'm going to say Automata kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office really quick. Was I correct? Last week I said that Gone Girl was going to win with $40 million. I was pretty close. A lot of people were lowballing it lower into the 30s. And some people were even saying if it just makes 25 or more, it's going to do well. It made $37.5 million over the weekend, which is phenomenal, especially for like a 2.5 hour movie. That is ultimately a grown-up film. It does not rely on teenage audiences. But what's also interesting is it beat Annabelle by just like $400,000. Not even $500,000 separated these two for the weekend. So talk about there was one that won the weekend. There really was no loser in the first two spots with Gone Girl and Annabelle. They both did extremely well. $37 million for each of them. I was pretty close with my Gone Girl estimation. And this is cool. But what's interesting is Gone Girl cost 10 times as much to make than Annabelle. And I'm sure that Gone Girl is going to have longer legs and it's going to have award potential. Annabelle's going to kind of burn itself out by Halloween. And that's fine because it's already made all its money back. It costs like $6 million to make. We're having a much stronger last third of the year than we did the first two thirds of the year. And I think that's just, you know, things run in cycles and this is a cyclical nature. Then you have Left Behind, which did not do terribly well. It made $6.3 million, which is pretty miserable considering it was meant to be a big production. And it cost four times as much as the original Left Behind, and it made just a little bit more than it did. It was not a good movie. So, Yeah. The rest of the entries fall into place. This week, I think Gone Girl will probably hold on to the box office, mainly because there's no juggernaut movie. There's no movie that everyone wants to see, and they're releasing a ton of them. They're also releasing Addicted out, which is based... I didn't talk about it because I didn't get a chance to see it. It's based on an erotic book by Zane, is the woman's name who writes it. That's the pen name she uses. That is out. None of these are like screaming, hey, you got to see this movie. You know, and it's sort of spread around. You got Alexander for the kids and the families. You got Dracula for the sort of the teenagers. You've got The Judge for the grown-up audience. Same thing with Kill the Messenger. You've got Addicted for the romance, erotics, and African-American audience. So it's sort of spread around. There's no movie that everyone's talking about like Gone Girl was last week. So I think Gone Girl is going to win with $25 million, and then Alexander and Dracula are going to be not very far behind. All right, you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies, and that sound means it's time to roll into the world-famous DVD Roundup. Topping the list of my picks is Edge of Tomorrow, which is kind of being marketed. It's being marketed as Live, Die, Repeat, Edge of Tomorrow, which shows that the Warner Brothers said that was a terrible name. I'm not even saying they needed to go back to All You Need Is Kill. Edge of Tomorrow was such... First of all, it sounded like a soap opera, but it also just didn't tell you anything about the movie. Live, Die, Repeat is what it said. And then tiny little on the cover box, Live, Die, Repeat, Edge of Tomorrow, Tom Cruise, Emily Blunt. This is a great movie, and it's sad that it didn't do better this summer because it was probably one of the better summer movies out there in terms of well-made, effective science fiction that kept my interest. It was a great film. I enjoyed the heck out of it. And I watched it again on Blu-ray. It looks fantastic. It sounds fantastic. It has some decent special features. It could be a little more packed, but hey, for the Blu-ray transfer alone, it's a beautiful film. So it's worth checking out. If you haven't seen it, pick it up. Don't let Tom Cruise scare you. It's a good movie. There's also A Million Ways to Die in the West, which also did not do very well this summer. This is Seth MacFarlane's send up of the Western genre. Again, this is a fun movie. It's entertaining. It's raunchy as all get out. It's very typical Seth MacFarlane humor. I think they were hoping for another Ted, and they did not get it. But that's okay. I still thought it was an entertaining film. So that's one that's worth checking out. Million Dollar Arm, another million movie. That's the one with John Hamm going to India to find a baseball player. This is a fine movie. It's not a great movie, and it is very sort of typical Touchstone kind of film. So yeah, it's a good film. Worth checking out. I enjoyed it. And it's if you haven't seen it, it's the kind of thing you can watch with your mom or your dad if he's into baseball. Obvious Child, which stars Jenny Slate as a woman in New York struggling with whether or not to get an abortion. A pretty level-headed approach to the discussion. I mean, it's such a polarizing topic. I thought they did a fine job sort of not getting into a screaming match about the topic. There's also Sleeping Beauty, Diamond Edition. The Disney Vault has opened up, and we've got Sleeping Beauty, which is, of course, timed perfectly to go with Maleficent, which came out earlier this summer. It was a huge hit, and will be coming out in the next couple weeks on Blu-ray and DVD. So if you want to get the real Sleeping Beauty story before you get the redacted Sleeping Beauty story, this is out there. Diamond Edition, Disney does a great job with these things. They're DVDs and Blu-rays. Set up with tons of special features, and they look gorgeous on the disc. There's also Sharknado 2, the second one. Sorry for such a step down from Sleeping Beauty. Sharknado 2, the second one. I don't know what else to say about that. It's about another Sharknado. Tara Reid and Ian Ziering. These are the new powerhouses of sci-fi. There's also, for the TV watcher, you've got Psych, the complete series, if you didn't get all the individual discs. Which is a great series. It's on Netflix, but if you want to own it before it goes off, you can. American Horror Story Coven, which is something to check out before you get into American Horror Story Freak Show, which is airing now. Bates Motel Season 2, not a bad update of the Norman Bates legend on A&E. And then the following Season 2 is also available on DVD and Blu-ray. The Stinger of the Week is Duck Dynasty Season 6 because it's reality TV and people, don't you have anything better to do with your lives than to watch crappy reality TV? My time is up. I need to get out of here. Join me next week when I talk about The Best of Me, The Book of Life, and Fury. Until then, Have a fat time at the movies.